The Tom Woods Show, episode 2297.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, I don't know about you, but I am running into a lot of progressives saying, look, police, fire, schools, these are all great examples of socialism. Well, let's focus on that school example. I've got a free ebook called Education Without the State that makes a pretty darn good case for a stateless approach to education. Pick it up at nostateeducation.com. Hey folks, Tom Woods here. Our old friend Steve Dace is back with us today. Man, this guy is productive. You will find Steve on Blaze TV. I got to know Steve when he was a radio host in Iowa, and he was one of those people whose endorsement everybody ahead of the Iowa caucuses sought because he had an audience, this guy. And now his star has only risen with his work on Blaze TV. He's executive producer of the forthcoming film Nefarious, coming out next month, I think. April, right, Steve?
April 14th, theaters nationwide, Tom.
All right, excellent. And he is co-author of the book that landed him another appearance on The Tom Woods Show, and that is Rise of the Fourth Reich, Confronting COVID Fascism with a New Nuremberg Trial So This Never Happens Again. So glad to talk to you again, Steve. Congratulations on yet another book.
Thank you, brother. Really appreciate it. And second time I've had a bestseller, according to the Wall Street Journal and Publishers Weekly, that the New York Times decided to completely ignore. And frankly, I think that's the greatest honor of them all. I love their ignoring and shunning of me. I take it as quite the compliment.
Yeah, I totally hear you. There are all kinds of things that the New York Times can do to you. I've been attacked for one of my books that was on the list. Then a second one of my books got on the list and they decided better to ignore it because the first time they attacked it, it reached its highest point on the list after the attack. So then they just ignored it. So I don't know. They don't know what to do with the likes of you and me, but I'm really glad to hear about the success of the book. I mean, really, you and I think it's safe to say that you and I have multiplied our audiences by some factor, maybe by two, maybe by one point something. As a result of all this, people just desperate to get some kind of sensible take on what's been going on.
Our audience at The Blaze, Tom, on our show has gone up over 400%
That's insane.
Last 3 years.
Wow.
It's absolutely insane. I went from having a podcast that iTunes didn't even rank and wondering if my contract was going to get renewed to I got a 3-year extension, and now I'm routinely in the top 50 on iTunes in our lead category. And I didn't change my worldview at all. I didn't moderate on anything at all. It's just what you said. People were so desperate to cling to anything or anyone that they thought might be willing to tell the truth and or challenge the prevailing narrative that they were being given. And it wasn't like we upped our marketing budget. People just organically found us.
Yeah, amazing. Well, great. Good for you. It's nice to see one of the good guys do well. Before we get into some of the specific names in this book, I want to address a part of your title, namely the words, "So This Never Happens Again." The trouble we face here, because of course I agree with you, the last thing in the world I want is to ever have to endure anything like this again. But the problem we face is, as you saw in 2022, some of the worst perpetrators were happily enough returned to office.
Mm-hmm.
There are millions and millions and millions of people throughout the United States and worldwide who insist on thinking, well, they were in a tough spot and they did the best they could and they probably saved a lot of lives by what they did and we need to support them. There are a ton of people who think that way, which makes it hard, it seems to me, to make sure this never happens again. If these people are actually held up as being worthy of re-election, then what hope is there?
That is an excellent point, Tom. And it's why I think when you look at a lot of the other things that are, to quote Shakespeare, hell is empty for all the devils are here in our culture right now. And you can see their origins come from certain elite or pagan, maybe even I might use the even term, irreligious or demonic facets of American life. And they're kind of being forced down the throats of average Americans. This one, I think, actually is a bit in reverse. I think when you're talking about less than 15% of American adults didn't take any of the gene juice, less than 15%. Everyone consented to some degree to be locked down. Everyone consented to some degree to be masked if you wanted to get on a plane, all right, even if you were going to defy the grocery stores and things of that nature. And so in this case, the corruption is molecular. It's subatomic. There isn't a singular home in America that can say, yep, we never succumbed to this whatsoever. We never bought into it at all. We defied it all the way. No one can say that. And I think there are a lot of people right now with things like died suddenly, collapsed suddenly. I think a lot of people don't want to contemplate that when they try to get their wives pregnant, they're the next guy who can't because of what it does to sperm motility. When they try to get pregnant, they're the next wife who can't because of what it does to the female reproductive system. They don't want to contemplate that I'm the next person that'll just wake up one morning and I won't have hearing in my ear. I'll collapse suddenly. And so let's just move on. I don't want to think about it. It might not be me. The odds are pretty high. It won't be. And so let's forget this ever happened. We're not getting any more boosters. If you look at the numbers, they have just continued to plummet into single digits now of people who are getting the latest round of boosters around the country. And I think in this case, it is not the system that is not willing to have any form of reckoning at all. You're seeing Republicans in Congress, as long as it's on the origins of the virus and not lockdowns and the jab, because that would obviously not be good for Trump's narrative. You're seeing them willing to go to the nth degree on that. We just had 419 to nothing vote in the House of Representatives to declassify everything we had on the origins of COVID. When was the last time you had 419 to nothing vote on anything other than, hey, who likes apple pie in the Congress? I think in this case, Tom, the people want to just move on because all of them are concerned that in some way, shape, or form, they let this corrupt them. They want to move on. They don't want to relive it. They don't want to relitigate it. The problem with that, though, is from Adam in the garden to now, whenever we're like, ah, oh, we don't have time for this confrontation, it always comes back again, but worse every time. That's the lesson of history.
Yes, absolutely. I have to say the one thing, or maybe one of a handful of things that pleasantly surprised me out of this was how many people were actually willing to stand up to the so-called, quote-unquote, public health establishment. I would have thought certainly a Mitt Romney GOP would have just rolled right over and insisted that nobody's allowed to ask any questions, and you certainly can't ask any questions about the shots. And as it turns out, a Mitt Romney GOP did do exactly that. But what is surprising is how many people are not part of a Mitt Romney GOP.
Right.
And how many people are not even part of a GOP? I suppose you've heard the rumblings that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is considering running as a Democrat. I think that would be fascinating to watch.
I agree.
Would be really great. It's too bad about his voice problem, but he can overcome that with the strength of his message. It's been great to see how many people just don't care that the elites tell them they're supposed to listen to Anthony Fauci. They just don't care. And that's a white pill for the future.
Completely agree. I did an event in Nashville with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. a couple of months ago, and got a chance to get to know him and to meet him and spend a day with him. And I just told him right to his face, Tom, hey, when I got into this, man, as a young Reaganite right winger, I got into this to defeat people like you. Now I'm going to do something that I almost never do in this line of work and ask, can I get my picture taken with you? Now, don't get me wrong. Him and I still have a host of political disagreements. Okay. But what you're talking about, the West is in systemic and deep epistemological crisis right now. Before we even get to our rival ideologies and political agendas, what the hell is actually true? What's real? Okay. What's actually true? And the last few years, I mean, I've gotten to be good friends with Dr. Naomi Wolf, the proud feminist icon of the Clinton administration. When I first started doing this show, as you mentioned back in the day in Iowa, I was responding to things that Bill Maher was producing on specials like Religious. Okay. Now I play his clips and I nod along with them. Now, I'm pretty sure Bill and I haven't changed our positions on a lot of issues, but here's what has changed. The old culture war argument in America, Tom, used to be that everyone agreed you had some form of individual agency, whether you thought it was just because you're a highly evolved human being or you thought you're made in the image and likeness of God. Everyone agreed everyone had some autonomy and agency as an individual. The argument was, what was the extent of that agency? How far could you go with it? Was there a higher moral code to be held accountable to other than as long as the other party is consenting, it's okay? That was essentially the argument, the culture war argument. Bill Maher and I both agreed that as him as an atheist and me as a guy who puts the fun in fundamentalism, we both agreed you have individual agency, value, worth, and autonomy. I just would make the argument, if we allow your conscience to be dictated by nothing other than your own whims, society careens over a cliff. He would push back and say, well, who's the boss of me, right? That was the argument for a generation or two, post-boomer, the sexual revolution of the 60s. Which changed in the last decade in America is that the new culture war argument is, do I have conscience at all? Do I have autonomy or agency at all? Am I simply a ward of the state? Do I just go back and forth between next current things? Did I get the download? Okay, the mask goes out of my bio. We put the Ukraine flag in. Ukraine flag goes out. All right, here's my jab card. The jab card goes out. All right, cool. Insert my pronouns, right? Are we automatons? And so now people like Bill Maher, the atheist, and me, the guy who puts the fund in fundamentalism, we're actually making a lot of the same arguments. Russell Brand and I are virtually doing the exact same show, even though I'm talking about a biblical worldview and he is advocating transcendental meditation. Why? Because we're not even getting to have the traditional culture war argument now, because now we're arguing, do I have individual liberty at all? Not what is the extent of my liberty, not how far can it go. Does it actually exist? And I do think that has created a new epistemological coalition in the country for sure. And I think that's the white pill that you're describing.
You know, we have only so much time together, Steve, and so much to cover. Start off by talking about the unusual and unique organization of this book, the style of the presentation you're making, and then let's jump right into Teresa Long and the shots.
Sure. My co-host Daniel Horowitz and I, we decided to structure this book like an actual trial. We timed the book, which was hard with supply chain issues in the current economy, to try to get it out this winter as soon as we could for people to have it to take to their state legislatures during session. Friends of ours who we assumed would be in the majority in Congress now. So we frame this like a trial. It doesn't just have a table of contents. It has a witness list. The witnesses are broken down into different categories, whether it's what happened in the medical profession, what happened as it pertains to the toxic jab, et cetera. Everybody's on the record. There isn't a narrative. You are going to read the raw transcripts of the actual witness interviews. We have the actual audio of all these interviews. So if anybody wants to come at us, we have the actual recordings. Everybody's consented to these. Everybody, again, on the record, no one is anonymous. It begins with an opening statement where we lay out the overall case against what's happened the last few years as a closing statement where we close the case, but then also offer in the appendix the kinds of policy solutions that you could have implemented at a mostly state and local level, because that's where a lot of the coercion and the tyranny was implemented, was at the state and local level. So this book is absolutely structured like a mock trial.
Right. So you're going to call witnesses. And the first of your witnesses, I think, is Teresa Long.
Mm-hmm.
And you're talking to her about the shots. What was her role in all this and what conclusions did she reach?
Teresa Long, very decorated lieutenant colonel, and she happened to be inputting data one day into what's called the DMED. And for people that don't know what that is, that's the Department of Defense's Medical Epidemiology Database. It is probably the most intense, specific, rigorous, and surveilled medical database in the country, public or private sector, because every single member the enlisted forces of the United States military has a file in there. And obviously, if anybody, if there's any institution where we're interested in keeping tabs on people's physical capabilities and health, it would be the DMED. And she began seeing skyrocketing percentages of codes pertaining to neurological or cardiovascular issues appear within the DMED shortly after vaccination. And what you're going to see in her testimony, which, and this is why we led off with her, because her testimony sets a tone for what will happen in the rest of the book. When she went to her superiors, and in some cases, she even names them. When she went to her superiors to alert them, Tom, to what was going on with these safety markers in the DMED data, you would think, again, we need live soldiers. We don't have the robot soldiers yet, right? You'd think you'd not want to be poisoning the people that you're going to put on the front lines defending the country. Time and time again, her superiors not only couldn't be convicted to act, they didn't care. They didn't care. They tried to get rid of her. They tried to stop her from testifying in a court case. I mean, the lengths they went to discredit this woman, to destroy her, and it was all because of what she was pointing out was in the DMED data in terms of safety signals post-vaccination for what we keep telling the country, these are the best men and women we have, and yet we cared not for taking care of almost any of them, despite what the DMED data was showing. And she's the first whistleblower that we cite in the book. And we put her there to set the tone right away. This is not going to be your average after the fact tell-all. This thing is a tour de force.
Only because of the time constraint, I actually want to jump ahead, if you don't mind,
sure,
because I want to make sure we get Brooke Jackson in here because of her role or her knowledge about the Pfizer clinical trials. I didn't know about this story at all. I didn't know most of these people, I'll be honest with you, Steve, and I feel like I followed this matter pretty closely.
So that's why we wrote the book, Tom, to make them more known. Exactly.
Well, good, good, good. Because I mean, I feel like somebody who wrote about it almost every day, if I'm not familiar with some of these people, then I bet a lot of people are. So the job you and Daniel Horowitz did was really tremendous. By the way, tell Daniel Horowitz to follow me on Twitter, will you? That drives me crazy. I follow him very faithfully. Okay.
I'll text him right when we get done here. You bet.
All right. I appreciate that. All right. But tell me the story of Brooke Jackson, because this is fascinating.
So Brooke Jackson is actually in the news right now. And she is someone, basically quality control is what she did for vaccine and cutting edge medicine testing. And so she works with the people that companies bring in to make sure they are following appropriate procedures, dotting I's, crossing T's, everything's on the up and up. She is stationed in Texas, and she was brought in by Pfizer to monitor several of their vaccine testing centers throughout the state of Texas. And she will, in her chapter, itemize the appalling conditions she found, completely blowing up control groups, unblinding people, letting family members take part in the trials, just total and complete no-nos.
By the way, what does unblinding people mean?
It means we no longer know whether someone's in a control group or not to get an honest assessment of the study, all right? We are just cooking the books. That's essentially what it means.
Okay.
All right? And in another context, we might call it doxing, if we were talking about social media, for example. And so the point is, you want to know who got the placebo, who did not, or you don't want to actually know that going in so that the results speak for themselves. You have an actual control group. One of the things that you see throughout what I call the launch of COVID Stan in March of 2020, whether it was Sweden on lockdowns, whether it's the real trial data on the jabs, whether it's we're going to just scrub 90 years of studies on masks as of June of 2020 and just terraform quote unquote new science in real time, there could never be any control groups. Anything that would test the integrity of what was being imposed on us instantly had to be discredited, memory hold, et cetera. All right. And so she saw this within the actual trials. She saw non-medical personnel injecting people, putting needles in people's arms. All right. She's on the record with all of this. She actually filed a lawsuit against Pfizer because of what she saw. They tried to get her case dismissed. Just about 2 weeks ago, the judge gave her standing, denied them summary judgment. Her case is going to trial right now as we speak. So if people want to look for her in the news, Brooke Jackson is in the news right now.
That's a tremendous story. Now, incidentally, what we've talked about so far has to do, you call it the gene juice, has to do with the COVID shots. On a topic like this, I don't even bother putting the episode on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
I don't bother because I know what's going to happen. How dare I say anything? Because we all know that it's safe and effective. I mean, it's crazy propaganda. So I don't even bother. I just use the other options that I have. And generally, podcast apps have been pretty good. They're like almost the last bastion.
Agreed.
Of freedom of speech. I don't know how long that'll be the case. Although I already think there's been a backlash against YouTube. I mean, Rumble, and to a lesser extent, Odyssey, have really taken off.
Yep.
Genuinely because of this. I wasn't sure they'd ever really get traction. But this has really been getting ridiculous. How have you actually been coping with trying to publicize a book that is, in many of its chapters anyway, dealing with the literally unaskable questions?
It's been difficult. When we released Fauci and Bargain, and that book became a number one overall bestseller, without really, outside of shows like yours and a few others, it had no external publicity at all. We finally got on Tucker Carlson, but that was after we hit number one. Then he helped us hit number one again. But you still couldn't even talk about the true origins of COVID. When we published that book in March of 2021, you got instantly banned still. It was another month or so before you were able to actually talk about the lab origin of COVID-19 on social media. Now, I still have, my page gets completely crushed by Facebook, YouTube. Those are the two worst. And you know, YouTube's the second largest search engine on the planet next to Google. So that's not a coincidence. That's where the censorship is worst. There's still a lot of people, even on the traditional right, that don't want to talk about this the way that Daniel and I lay it out. because even though I don't think Donald Trump's name is mentioned one time in this book, you cannot possibly, if you're any form of a sentient human, make the ultimate connection that a lot of this began and started and was endorsed at the time by him. I mean, I would argue that the absolute most destructive foreign policy of my lifetime was the invasion of Iraq. The absolute most destructive domestic policy of my lifetime is Operation Warp Speed, according to the CDC's own VSafe data. And that's important for your audience to know, Tom, is that the CDC has actually been closely monitoring the safety signals with the COVID vaccines from the beginning. They just have ignored VAERS, the traditional vaccine adverse event reporting system that's existed since they were given indemnity, the manufacturers were in the 80s and 90s. They created a separate one called VSafe. And this is a massive database of about 10 million people they've been following all along. Their numbers actually show about 7% of people reported a major adverse event up to and including death after getting COVID vaccinated, which almost is perfectly in line with the Rasmussen poll earlier this year that showed 7.7% of Americans had reported a serious adverse event up to and including death with the COVID-19 vaccines. They know all this. It's just they've all got trillions of dollars at stake. They had to take hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin. They had to make them, quote unquote, dangerous medications because you can't have an emergency use authorization legally. If there's another medication that's already safe and effective on the market, there's no point in justifying the collateral damage when there's already something we've already tested on the market. So all of this is laid out in the book. You're going to hear stories of people whose loved ones were medically kidnapped, couldn't get treatment, died in hospitals. When we suggested calling the book Rise of the Fourth Reich, our publisher, Post Hill, who's great, by the way, but they, of course, balked because you put that in the title, you're going to limit your marketing ability for sure. Okay. So we said to the publisher, here's our opening statement. Read it. If there's anything factually wrong or you still think the title goes too far, we'll come up with another one. We sent them our opening statement and the publisher came back to us and said, now we're kind of thinking the book ought to be titled Our Ancestors Shot Redcoats for Less Than This. Okay. This book, this is not bedtime reading. I've had tons of people email me, man, I read at night before I go to bed. I read your book and I'm so mad. I'm so pissed off. I'm so angry. I can't get to sleep. My adrenaline is so high. Okay. Because what transpired here is savagery. It's inhuman. It's demonic. And we've never seen, Tom, in all of human history, every government in the world, almost every government in the world, on March 16, 2020, without a shot fired or a treaty signed, beat their swords into plowshares, eliminated their borders, and said, yes, we will impose these policies on almost the entire human race with few exceptions. We've never seen anything like that, which is why Daniel and I call it the Fourth Reich.
And, you know, something like masks almost seems trivial next to what was mandated with regard to the shots. But the mask thing is also, I mean, I'll admit, at the beginning, not knowing anything about anything, I thought to myself, well, maybe there's a chance masks can help us get out of this. At least
I actually went on my show not knowing we had done 90 years of studies post.
Right. I know.
Flu in 1918, flu, the Spanish flu. I said, why, instead of lockdowns, we can't live like this. Instead of lockdowns, we'll just wear masks like they do in Asia. We'll get through this.
Yeah.
And then my inbox got bombarded with people sending me every study since 1919 that shows that they don't work. Okay.
Yeah. And then you get people saying, yeah, well, what about surgeons who wear masks? And you find out there are scholarly papers showing that doesn't do anything.
Right.
You know, and of course, I would assume that it would. Anyway, but just today, I was telling you it's my daughter's birthday as we record this. And we were at a trampoline park and they still have the sign up saying, for your health, please wear a mask. There's nobody wearing a mask in this place. So I want to just rip that sign down. Like, I'm just sick of this. I want to rip the sign down. My wife's kind of restrained me so we don't get thrown out of the place. So I said, well, how about this compromise? I'll just post underneath it. Well, now that we have the Cochrane study that explodes the useless, it shows the uselessness of masks, you can ignore the sign above this one. I mean, I wondered what was the fanaticism about masks. Number one, it was to keep the hysteria going. But number two, I had a friend who said that the left probably likes the egalitarian aesthetic of it, that we're all the same. We're all wearing the mask. It's all creepy. It is not because it's actually going to do any good for you, because if it did, the world would look different if masks did any good. The world would look different.
Yeah, you've been wearing one of those every cold and flu season. You're in everywhere all your lives.
Right.
Since 1918, since the Spanish influenza, you'd have worn one of those every respiratory virus season. So if you live in a northern climate, that's the winter, because we're indoors more. If you're in a southern climate, tropical climate, that's the summer, because then you're indoors more. Those are the peak seasons. Those were, by the way, why you had the peak waves of COVID during those seasons in those regions because it's a respiratory virus. So if these things worked, you would have been wearing them your entire life during those peak seasons. Why didn't we wear them? Because we did 90 years of studies. And you can even go find places, you know, the University of Minnesota's Center for Infectious Disease, Michael Osterholm, who worked in the Biden White House and with five other administrations. He still had papers on his website showing masks didn't work as recent as May of 2020, Tom. And then suddenly, all these things just all instantly disappeared like a Thanos snap because they had the new science now. They had the new speak now. And four legs were good, but two legs now are even better.
Yeah. That's it. Hey, everybody. Today's show is sponsored by Gold Alliance. If you're concerned about high inflation, looming recession, a stock market correction, or out-of-control spending in Washington, this is an important message to hear. Because the fact is, during every major crisis in U.S. history, many of those who fail to prepare watch their savings, investments, or retirement funds go down, while many with the foresight to own gold helped preserve their purchasing power. Gold even made some folks richer. Now we're facing several major crises at once, and experts say we may soon face even more economic trouble. So please don't wait. Learn the simple way you can diversify with gold and put yourself on the road to financial peace of mind, even in uncertain times. The new free 2023 Gold Guide from our friends at Gold Alliance can show you how. Just visit freegoldguide.com/Tom or call 800-317-3808. That's freegoldguide.com/Tom or call 800-317-3808.
One of the things that takes us a little bit out of the book, though, aren't we hearing constantly that studies find that millions of lives were saved by the shots? And then you look at these studies, and it's all speculative modeling, like there's really nothing to them, but people walk away with the idea that millions of lives were saved. I mean, do you have a glib response to that?
Yes. 1,600% better chance that you would suffer an adverse event from the COVID-19 vaccine than you would die of COVID. That's my glib response.
Where would I go to find that?
You do the math. You simply do the math. It's 7.7% of people suffered an adverse event, according to the CDC's own VSafe data. Just do that vis-a-vis. So you have an IFR for COVID of about 0.3. That's on the high side, by the way. We estimate it on the high side. You'll get 0.3. All right. So 0.3% odds that you were going to die with COVID before we ever stratify for AIDS. That's just the blanket egalitarian number. 0.3 was the infection fatality rate for COVID-19. 7.7% of people reported to CDC they had a major adverse event up to and including death. Then you do the math on hospitalization. COVID hospitalization rate, 2.5%. You'd be in the hundreds of percentage greater likelihood of having an adverse event to the COVID vaccine than being hospitalized for COVID itself. Frankly, we didn't need the COVID vaccines. The Israeli data showed the number one marker for COVID hospitalization, vitamin D deficiency. Over 70% of the people in Israel that were hospitalized with COVID during the worst waves all exhibited vitamin D deficiency. We could have actually just done what Anthony Fauci said once to Jennifer Garner, the actress, but then never said again publicly, hey, I take 10,000 IUs of vitamin D a day. If we're going to spend money, let's spend money on stuff that works. We could have just sent everybody a simple metric for how to measure what is the optimum vitamin D consumption for them based on their body mass. It's a fat-soluble vitamin. We could have just done that. And one great way to get vitamin D, by the way, is to go out in the sun and be active. But we told everybody in the spring and summer of 2020, it wasn't safe to be outside in the bright sunlight. But now in the winter of 2023, it's perfectly safe to be out in the plum and mushroom chemical cloud of East Palestine, Ohio. That's perfectly safe though.
Yeah. And I remember, and I live in Florida, and there was a guy, a lawyer, who dressed up as the Grim Reaper and would show up on Florida beaches, suggesting you were going to die because you went to the beach.
Yes.
I mean, he should be humiliated, mortified, and for some reason he isn't, because if these people were capable of embarrassment, they would behave quite differently from how they do. Do you have time to spend a few minutes talking about Scott Miller?
You bet.
Because here's a guy, was he a physician's assistant?
Yeah, he's a physician's assistant in Washington State, which means, for people that don't know, he's not a doctor, but he has some limited ability, depending on how your state regulates, some ability to actually prescribe medications, all right, and treat as a physician would. And so in the state of Washington, he had almost full ability to do that. He just decided, based on research, studies of research that he had done on COVID-19 treatment around the world, to start working with things like hydroxychloroquine, budesonide, things that nebulizers, things of that nature, and started to see tremendous success treating COVID-19 as a severe respiratory ailment, particularly early on before patients developed what was known as the cytokine storm. And that's when the inflammation has reached its peak and you're probably going to end up in a hospital. And at that point, it's a flip of a coin, man, if you're ever coming out. And so he was tremendously successful, treated scores of patients to the point that by the end of this, it's almost like that scene in Miracle on 34th Street when all the Santa letters get delivered to the courthouse, right? You know what I'm talking about? Okay.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they literally were holding parades for this guy. I mean, people were like, you saved my life. You saved my nan-pop's life, my nana's life. Okay. So of course, because of that, they had to target him for extinction, put his accreditation on trial, try to get him decertified. And there are numerous medical professionals that we could have pointed out. They did this to huge names. They did this to Peter McCullough, maybe the most decorated cardiologist in American history. Started not one, not two, but three different medical journals that still exist today. So the reason why we put Scott's story in there is because, again, we wanted our audience to see just how subatomic and granular this was. That if this system was willing to target a PA and BFE Washington State, then clearly they were closing the loop absolutely everywhere they could. This was systemic. It wasn't an accident. It wasn't they were blindsided and they didn't know what to do, cut them some slack. They never once showed any empathy, Tom. They never once on their own said, oh man, that didn't work, or we went too far. Every time they pulled back, it's because the resistance got too much to be enforceable or the courts made them do it. They never did it voluntarily. They never showed any remorse, any self-awareness whatsoever. This wasn't about being blindsided. This was about never let a good crisis go to waste. That's what it was about. And so if we're at the point that even a PA in Washington State can be the target of a statewide regulatory agency for extinction, they weren't going to leave any stone unturned. And that's, again, why we call it the Fourth Reich.
Well, let me just say this. It seems, given all the things you've described and what we've all witnessed, that we have such a task ahead of us in terms of building parallel institutions. I mean, how is somebody who is sensible and willing to look at evidence and not just go with the herd, who wants to go to medical school, supposed to navigate a system that churns out people of the sort who would persecute Scott Miller?
Mm-hmm.
So what are we supposed to do? I mean, do we have to build our own system that doesn't require their accreditation of the medical schools? I mean, I don't even know where to begin, to be honest with you.
I don't think there's any parallel for this in human history. And this is where I'm going to, again, put the fund in fundamentalism and look at this from the perspective of the history of my Christian faith. It's not new for Christianity, starting with Good Friday, okay, and to this period of time, to be on the outskirts of the mainstream of a civilization. That's not a unique position. Now, how Christians responded in the Roman Empire and then well into, you know, I like to say on my show, the Catholic Church created Western civilization. The Protestant Reformation probably saved it. Okay. So what we call Western civilization is basically just Christendom. That's basically what it is. Codes, edicts, doctrines, socioeconomic theories, values, largely inspired by the prevalence and influence of Christianity at different points in time in this part of the world. And so the early Christians realized we're not just going to discard these babies that the concubines and the prostitutes are having, just discarding them out into fields to die. Then we're going to have to create, as you just said, parallel institutions. This is where hospitals and orphanages came from. This is why to this day, most of your hospitals are called Mercy, Sisters of So-and-so, Saint So-and-so. All right, those are references to the origins of the worldview that created them. What is unique, though, is that those same institutions now that our faith created and inspired have been completely taken and given over, in most cases, to this spirit of the age that we see today. And so that is what's new. What is new is that we did create parallel institutions centuries ago. They're almost all gone now. And so now, do we take them back? Is that even possible? Do we create all new ones? Do we even have time for that? This is the great dilemma people who believe in any form of human liberty face right now in the West, is the very question that you just posed.
A crisis like this that we just endured has heroes and villains. Now, the villains, most of them, we know their names, we know their faces. But most of the heroes have labored in obscurity, and that's not an accident. Why would they be highlighted? Sometimes our heroes are highlighted in order to be ridiculed and dismissed, but in general, they ignored them. And as we mentioned earlier, as somebody who followed this fairly closely, I was not familiar with most of the people you chronicle in this book, but we genuinely need heroes because, for one thing, we need to be inspired by them, but justice demands it that people who were courageous at a real time of testing, they deserve to have their names remembered and their deeds remembered in the same way that we want to remember the bad and wicked deeds of terrible, awful people, so as to try to prevent a recurrence of that. And so your book is doing two things. It's not only giving us information that we didn't have, that many of us didn't have, or the specifics about the shots and all the various measures they took that were useless or counterproductive, but also you're doing a good deed by holding up all these folks who, as I say, labored in obscurity. Some of them lost everything for the sake of what was good and true. And so for that reason, I hope people will read the book that you co-authored with Daniel Horowitz, Rise of the Fourth Reich, Confronting COVID Fascism with a New Nuremberg Trial So This Never Happens Again. I'm going to link to it at tomwoods.com/2297. I hope it continues to be a big success for you and that your film coming out, Nefarious, next month is likewise a great success. I hope this is the year of Dace.
Oh, thank you, man. I appreciate it. That's very kind. Thank you, Tom.
Thanks so much for your time today.
You bet, brother. God bless.
All right, folks, before we go, I'd like to tell you about a site one of my listeners started. It's BitcoinFinancialAdvisorsNetwork.com. The Bitcoin Financial Advisors Network is a resource for people looking to incorporate Bitcoin into their overall financial plan, but without the usual fear, uncertainty, and doubt displayed by the average mainstream advisor. Bitcoin, of course, can weave itself into all aspects of personal finance, so retirement planning, insurance and benefits planning, portfolio and investment allocation, cash flow planning, tax planning, estate planning. So the website, again, BitcoinFinancialAdvisorsNetwork.com, that's advisors with an O-R, is a directory of independent fee-only advisors from around the country who specialize in various areas of expertise. So check that out, BitcoinFinancialAdvisorsNetwork.com. I will link to it at tomwoods.com/2283. And if you would like to get a website you're thinking about creating promoted by me, before you create that site, check out tomwoods.com/publicity and find out the ways I can help you. But you got to do that before you start that site. So tomwoods.com/publicity is the place to go, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.